Dave's Psych Lectures, part of the Thunderbird 6 podcasting network.
Okay, so when last we met, we were talking about antidepressants. Let's quickly go over this. Monoamine oxidase inhibitors, inhibitors, they just make the monoamines more available because they stop the metabolism of monoamines, break them down. Tricyclic antidepressants, they stop the reuptake of monoamines. So if you stop reuptake into an originating cell, you have more monoamines around. And selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, well, they inhibit the reuptake of serotonin. That seems pretty obvious by their name, so they just make more serotonin available. So it seems to be the case monoamines, specifically serotonin, are important. The neurochemical effects are immediate. You take the drug and it works. But unlike, say, antipsychotics, when you take those drugs, they block D2 receptors and you don't have hallucinations anymore and your paranoia goes away. The antidepressant effects can take days or even weeks. So there's more to this than simply... Some people will say that shows there's more to it than neurochemistry. Those people apparently don't understand that all behavior comes from your brain. Just that there's more to it than just simply the SSRIs. Or sorry, than just the monoamines or just the specific serotonin. Then there's lithium, and I talked very briefly about this last time. And lithium chloride is used. The nice thing is antidepressant drugs tend to be kind of expensive, whereas lithium chloride is a simple thing. It's a salt of lithium and chloride, hence the name. And you take a capsule. It can be a very dangerous drug. It controls the manic part of bipolar. Okay, so it controls the manic part of bipolar. But we don't really know how. It does. The dangerous thing about this, it's got a therapeutic index of like around 3, 3.5, depending on the person. Meaning if you take like 3 times the amount you're supposed to take, and you take 3 pills instead of 1, you die. That's not good, but you need 1 pill. That's really bad. That's kind of dangerous. And it's a rather nasty poisoning, it's not a fun way to die either. It's not like you fall asleep and never wake up. It's blood poisoning. It's not good. So what ends up happening is you turn green, and then you get very sick to your stomach, and it actually can't kill you. So I think I told you guys that I actually had a student that I was taking the stuff, and he just started, and he took it too many. With a lot of SSRIs, drugs like this, it says if you miss one dose, take two. You'll see that with a lot of drugs, right? You'll see that with a lot of antibiotics on the side. It says the doctor will say, look, if you miss a dose, just take two next time. You do that with lithium chloride, you kill yourself. So this is what this guy did. We got him to the hospital, he was okay, and he ended up getting 83 in intro psych, so good for him. But nonetheless, it was kind of a scary situation. We don't quite know how it works, but at least it's cheap. Got that going for us. All right. By the way, each of these slides is a whole, like, week in neuropharmacology. 3506. Just to let you know, you want to learn more, take that class next year. Just saying. Also, cross-listed as a biology class. Okay, let's talk about opiates. Opiates are interesting because, there are all these other drugs seem to have receptors, the barbiturates can actually operate a GABA receptor. Benzodiazepines act as GABA modulators. You got all that. These other drugs are working by blocking reuptake, etc., blocking receptors. Opiates are different. So that's like codeine and morphine. What they do is they actually are, in essence, the same thing as endorphins, which are neurotransmitters. They're basically the same molecule. Your brain kind of rolls its own. So there's 3 or 4 types. Why do I say or 4? You'll see in a second. There's the mu. They're just the average receptor. So... that was a statistics joke. There are very few statistics jokes. Here's another one. This one unbiased estimator walks into the bar and sees another one. He says, what do you think of being married? He says, it's okay as long as you don't mind losing your degree of freedom. So, see, it's not funny. That's it. That's all I got. There's no statistics isn't funny. Oh, you're back. Thank you. The mu receptors are for, again, they're opiate receptors. They're throughout the limbic system, your hippocampus and amygdala. They're in thalamus and locus coriolis. We haven't talked about locus coriolis yet. It's important in vision. Thalamus is important in all the sensory things except smell, right? We know that. Hippocampus supports memory and amygdala for emotion. So this is responsible for most of what I'm calling the interesting effects. These are the sort of, you know, hallucinations, that kind of stuff. They're emotional and perceptual things. They're going to be fun. They're going to be interesting. You're going to be kind of enjoyable. You know, the kind of like seeing things and feeling like you're flying, that kind of stuff. They have what's called a weak attraction, which means they have a great effect. That's I'm not going to go into explaining that, but so don't worry about that, actually. There's the delta receptor. This is the limbic system, too, but not in the same parts of the limbic system, and also in the cortex. The hypothalamus, the nucleus accumbens. Now, hypothalamus, this should tell you that it's going to have something to do with homeostatic things, things like your body temperature. In fact, one of the classic withdrawal symptoms from heroin is that you end up feeling cold and then feeling really hot. But not just chills, like it's horribly cold and like your skin's on fire. It doesn't sound very much fun, right? Cortex, it's going to affect obviously higher function. Nucleus accumbens, oh look. That's the reward system, isn't it? There's receptors for it, the reward system. I should tell you something. The medulla, so it's going to affect sleep. It's called the narcotic analgesic, so it's going to affect sleep. Medulla oblongata controls sleep and wakefulness. A lot of antipsychotic drugs also act on delta receptors, which is kind of interesting. As an aside. There's the kappa receptor. Also in the nucleus accumbens, which I've misspelled as the nucleus accumbens. The ventral tegmental area. Oh, look. Again, another kind of receptor. We have three for sure types. One that's iffy that I'll talk about in a sec. Of the three that are for sure opiate receptors, two of them have exist in the nucleus accumbens and one is in the ventral tegmental area. It's pretty clear that it's affecting your reward system. Hypothalamus again. And the thalamus again. Then there's the sigma receptor. This is not for just for opioids. This also can be the sigma receptor. Other chemicals can make the sigma receptor work. It seems to be all over the brain, and it leads to psychotic-like symptoms. So opiates then directly operate your reward system. And the interesting thing is they also kill pain. Those tend to be in more cortical regions. When we take a look at things like them affecting, they've been, you know, affecting hypothalamus, it's pretty obvious then that some of the withdrawal symptoms are going to happen here, are going to be messing around with homeostatic things like being warm and cold, you know, thermoregulation. One of the interesting withdrawal symptoms from these drugs is, in fact, that you involuntarily move your leg, which is called kicking back. That's where the term comes from. And the term cold turkey comes from getting goosebumps when you feel so very cold when you're going through withdrawal from these drugs. So now you've learned a little trivia for you. The para-aqueductal gray is full of opiate receptors, all kinds of them. And in fact, when you're in pain, those are the ones that the endogenous opiates, so endorphins, that's where those bond, okay? Those are in the amygdala, I talked about that also in the amygdala, generally, as you saw, generally in the respiratory, cough, and vomit parts of your brain. They actually repress that. They stop. This is why this stuff makes great cough meds. You ever had codeine cough medicine? You ever have a really bad cough and they'll give you a prescription for cough medicine? It just stopped coughing. Which is great, because that means that as soon as you stop having it, one of the withdrawal symptoms is you cough. One of the withdrawal symptoms is you vomit. Okay? I once had codeine cough medicine. There was some in our house because Isabel had a really bad cough back in Newfoundland. So bad she went to the hospital. She drove to the hospital. And it was really bad. She had for like 4 or 5 hours the whole time, just coughing for like 4 hours. She went to the hospital, got this cough medicine, and it said take 2 teaspoons. And I had a really bad cough, like a year later. And I misread, I took 2 tablespoons, which was a mistake. I was up all night, cough was gone, and I was just seeing things. So really, you should be really, really careful with this stuff. We don't have it anymore. You read the I think that says tablespoons. I'm really trying to be careful, too, because I know it's dangerous stuff. It's good with gin, though. I mix it with your gin in a shaker, and then that's a joke. You can die. That'll kill you. You'll be dead. So again, as you saw, so this is just sort of summarizing. It's on the reward system. There's got to be a good reason to put a needle in your arm, because it feels really good. Right? This is why people take things like heroin, or they take OxyContin to do that, of course, with pills. Or you can crush that and snort it. Okay, so let's talk about any questions about opiates before we move on to talk about cocaine. Okay, here's some interesting pictures. I love this. First of all, Coca-Cola doesn't have cocaine in it. It doesn't have trace amounts of cocaine in it. Stop thinking that. You ever heard that in like grade 7? You know, Coca-Cola's got cocaine in it. It did a very long time ago. Like in the 1890s when they invented Coca-Cola, the recipe, but it was a totally different thing. It was a tonic. You know, like the episode of The Simpsons where Homer and his father go on the road selling the tonic, like it's like a snake oil salesman, medicine show? It's always a Simpsons episode, shows around 30 freaking years. It was a patent medicine. It was used to cure everything. And a lot of these quote medicines, they had a lot of alcohol in them and a couple, and usually something like cocaine in them, because it made you feel better right away. And then by the time that Homer and his father have packed up and left town to the next town, or they've left town for somewhere else and you've already shot the bottle, and then you get on your horse and you got to go meet the woman and spread that redemption. Anybody? So there's a scene with a patent medicine guy in that. And what happens is the people figure it's a scam, but they can't catch it. So that's why it used to be sold in drugstores. You see old movies from 1940s, 1930s, people were in drugstores getting soda off because that's what they used to sell it, because it was originally medicine. Oh. It's a long time ago. It used to have, they called it wine. It was one of the ingredients. It wasn't really wine. It was rubbing alcohol, basically. Well, it was just ethyl alcohol. Okay, so it doesn't have, remember, there's no cocaine in it. Now, on the other hand, I love this picture here. Cocaine toothache drops, and there's 2 little kids. Anything that ends in ane is a local anesthetic. That's just because of the way we name things. It's not if you name something ane. If you say this is a chair ane, then you can use it. This doesn't matter. But so it's a naming convention. So it actually used to be used as, and it still could be used. It's a waste of valuable cocaine. But if you had a toothache, put it right on there. Which should remind you of the scene from the movie Blow, where Bobcat Goldthwait snorts the cocaine and says he can't feel his face. Right? Because it's perfect, pure cocaine. It's a great movie, actually. It's a really, really good movie. It's about the rise of the cocaine cartels in Medellin and the rise of the cocaine culture in the States. It's a great movie. I'm talking about cocaine, and also I'm talking about amphetamines. They all go together in psychomotor stimulants. I'm talking about amphetamines, I'm talking about cocaine, I'm talking about ecstasy. One of the things that they cause is release of catecholamines and serotonin, but without an action potential. There's just transmitter leakage. Ecstasy causes an increase in the amount of release of serotonin. Cocaine blocks reuptake of dopamine, which is one of the catecholamines. You can see then that they're all making the same things operate. And they all have the same effect. So no matter really what the drug is you're taking, they all do roughly the same thing. Ecstasy is a little bit different because of its causing the increase in the amount of serotonin released. Okay. Ecstasy also does something different than these drugs. I put it in with this category because it's very similar to amphetamine, molecularly. But people also include it in the category of hallucinogens, and it kind of fits there too. So it's kind of a weird drug that way. But it's probably more similar to an amphetamine. In the peripheral nervous system, you get the release of epinephrine with all these drugs. Now, if that's the case, that means these are going to be banned substances for athletic competitions. Because if you get an increase in the amount of adrenaline released, you can run faster, you can lift more, etc. Of course, it's offset by the fact that you're high. Which always amazed me. Those of you who ever followed baseball, there was a baseball player from Montreal Expos back in 1982, Tim Raines, and he had a coke problem. And I mean, he didn't have a small coke problem. He was snorting between innings. And he started doing a head-first slide. He was a base stealer. He should be in the Hall of Fame. He was a great batter, a great fielder. He was a whole lot of bases. And he started sliding head-first one year. And it turns out he was doing that because he was coke in his pocket. And he didn't want to slide the traditional way because his coke might come out. He batted 278 that year and stole 78 bases. Full of cocaine. I mean, really, seriously, if there's any reason he should be in the Hall of Fame, it's that. It's incredible. It's incredible. Okay, so that's how those things work. They're basically, they're going to get you up and going because you've got dopamine, typically in other catecholamines. There are dopamine receptors in the nucleus accumbens, and you've got the release of epinephrine. Okay? So let's go from an illegal drug to a legal one. And as usual, we don't really know how legal drugs work. It's one of those, I don't know why that is. They seem to block adenosine, which is a neuromodulator that inhibits firing. It inhibits firing of neurons that release excitatory neurotransmitters. So what happens is it looks like caffeine disinhibits. You'll hear sometimes hear people say, well, yeah, caffeine isn't really stimulating you. What it's doing is it's stopping you from not being stimulated, which is like, yes, yes. Tell me more about your knowledge of neuropharmacology. High doses, actually, of caffeine will block benzodiazepine receptors. So one of the things, in fact, that happens if you've got an overdose of diazepam, Valium, is one of the things they'll give you is a shot of caffeine. They're not only a shot of espresso, they'll give you, like, IV caffeine. It's almost a pot, because it's a stimulant, it's very difficult to overdose on this. Could you overdose on caffeine? Yes, you could. You'd have to, at the same time, drink 80 cups of coffee. So obviously, you'd be done with pills, but still, it's hard to overdose on caffeine. You can get negative effects. You can get something called caffeinism, which is when you get this kind of, you get really shaky and paranoid, that kind of thing. And that's probably haven't been done to you. You'd sit down and drink, like, in a 10-minute period, drink like 15 cups of coffee. You just can't do that. You have to pee first. So caffeine itself is a pretty, of all these drugs we're going to talk about, probably the safest of all of them. Caffeine's pretty safe. It's safe for pregnant women to take caffeine. Again, not to excess, but nothing to excess when you're doing anything. You know, but you don't go to the doctor and they say, when you're pregnant, they say, oh, no more coffee. They don't say that, right? I will say a couple things, though. Caffeine does cross the placental barrier, and you're giving your kid caffeine, which isn't a bad thing. It's not going to affect anything negatively. The only thing you can say is that the half-life of caffeine in an adult human is somewhere between 30 minutes and an hour and a half. The half-life of caffeine in a fetus or an infant or a little baby toddler is 3.5 days. So most expectant mothers notice that their baby gets more active and for a longer period of time when they've taken some caffeine, had some coffee. And there's caffeine in lots of things. Does anybody here not ingest caffeine? Right? So there you go. Because remember, there's caffeine in chocolate. Right? There's 10, 15, 20 milligrams of caffeine in a chocolate bar. There's caffeine in tea. There's caffeine in coffee, Coke, wake up pills, Red Bull, of course. This idea that Red Bull is somehow more dangerous than any other is just people that are stupid. It's got about the same amount of caffeine in it as a cup of coffee. It's about 125 milligrams of caffeine in a cup of coffee. The old you, well, it's twice, you know, a cup of coffee, the way it's typically measured, is it says in a teacup. No one drinks teacups of coffee. Also, they make it quite weak. Typically, people want stronger coffee, so a typical mug of coffee has a little over 100, 125 milligrams of caffeine. A can of Red Bull tends to be around 100 milligrams of caffeine. It's not dangerous. It's not good for you, probably, either, because of all the sugar in it. It tastes like really horrible cream soda. Is what Red Bull. If you want horrible cream, look, drink some coffee and have a cream soda. I mean, that's much more flavorful, it seems to me. Much more flavorful. The way it's dangerous, by the way, is that when you mix it with alcohol, and it's not dangerous for any other reason that we spot that when we're drunk by how it's called behavioral tolerance. You learn how to behave under the influence of certain drugs, right? Maybe you might have an uncle or some relative who or a friend who comes to you and says, "I'm an alcoholic." And you go, "Really?" And they go, "Yeah, I'm drunk right now." And you don't notice it because they're so used to it. They can function under the influence of whatever the drug is. Tim Rance could play baseball with on cocaine. His batting average dropped, but he was still a major league baseball player. So what I'm talking about here is, with alcohol, we notice when we're drunk, oftentimes by how tired we get. And if we block being tired by taking caffeine, we then drink more. That's where it's dangerous. That's no more dangerous than Irish freaking coffee. You ever drink Irish coffee? It's delicious. Whiskey, really good coffee, whipped cream on top. God, that's good. Irish whiskey, Jameson's, it's a little bit high-end for putting in that, but even that'll work. If you're Jameson, you drink it straight. It's kind of sacrilegious to put coffee in. I get so tired of people with their... I don't want all you taking drugs. Sounds like I'm like, you should all get high. But all I'm saying is I just want people to be told real things. Don't lie to people. Kids aren't stupid. Just tell them the truth. Oh. All right. Nicotine, now, smoking's good for you, know it. It's horrible. Okay, nicotine. Nicotine's a fascinating drug. You might wonder why people would suck on something and suck the smoke into their lungs. Because there's nicotine receptors in your cortex. Well, this doesn't shouldn't surprise you. People that smoke will tell you it focuses them. Helps them think. The basal ganglia, which is sort of the the stop between the old cortex and the new cortex, between the limbic system and cortex, where the connections are part. Look, the ventral tegmental area, the nucleus accumbens. That's the freaking reward system. So that's why people smoke, because it feels good to smoke. As my dad used to say, I don't care anybody says cigarettes taste good. I think what he meant was they make them feel good. So the thing about nicotine is that it's an insidious drug because it has this effect of making you feel good, but it's actually, and actually over the short term, it's not that dangerous. Sure, it's the long term use that's the problem, right? You don't get lung cancer from having a cigarette. It doesn't happen. There's probably some one guy once. No, there probably isn't. Effects of nicotine in the peripheral nervous system, you get tremors. So smokers can't hold their hands straight. I don't smoke. You get inhibition of various peripheral nervous system effects. This might seem odd, but it's because it's a stimulus, but you're inhibiting inhibition, so you get disinhibition because it's a stimulant. You get constriction of blood vessels. This is why smokers have cold extremities. You can often tell when someone's a smoker if you shake their hand. Their hands are cold.
But you think your hands are cold?
You're doing a lot of
that?
Yeah, all the
time.
Lighten
up?
Lighten
up? Yeah.
No,
you're
14.
I don't think I don't
need
to
smoke
cigarettes.
Also, oftentimes their nose will be cold, you know, like a dog. Of course, there are central nervous system effects in the reward system. You also get the release of norepinephrine, epinephrine, dopamine, and serotonin. It's a stimulant. Okay? If it's a stimulant, why do people smoke to relax? This is a great question. And anybody who has ever smoked will tell you that it's relaxing to smoke cigarettes. It relaxes you. This is called Nesbitt's paradox, which always kind of bugged me because it's like everybody's known this ever since people were smoking tobacco. They're smoking tobacco this way. So Native North Americans were smoking tobacco typically in ceremonial things, and they were smoking way more at once than Europeans ever did. But at least ever since the, people, for 400 odd years we've known, 500 years, people, they smoke to relax. And this guy Nesbitt comes along and goes, I'm going to put my name on that. That was kind of bugged me. So from now on, when it's raining but sunny out, you know, a sun shower, that's Broadbeck's paradox. Call it that. Put your name on something. When you have your lawnmower outside but there's snow, it's also Broadbeck's paradox. Any other paradox is Broadbeck's paradox. It pisses me off. I don't know. I'm sure Nesbitt was a good guy. I don't know. So why is this the case? Is it the physical act of smoking? Well, what do I mean by that? You can't be... The relaxing part of it is that you're perhaps doing something else, and you have learned that while you're doing X, you can't be doing Y, whatever it is that's upsetting. So the act itself becomes associated with relaxation.
Could be.
Could it just be getting rid of withdrawal? Nicotine withdrawal is a horrible feeling. It's not like heroin, except it lasts longer. People report cravings lasting 13 years at the highest that I've seen. So there is withdrawal from that. Could be that. Is it that there are nicotine receptors in the GABA system? Yes, that's a better explanation than any of them. And that's one you don't tend to hear about. I luckily heard about this at a conference I was at a long time ago, 2000? I was there with my friend Duncan, who pretty much invented smoking, by the way. I saw Duncan once smoke a cigarette, a cigar, a pipe, and chew nicotine gum at the same time. I'm not kidding, by the way. His beard, he had gray beard, but he was all yellow from nicotine. And he was one of the greatest guys you'd ever meet. He died of pancreatic cancer in 2006. He called me and told me he had cancer. I said, what, lung? Yeah. I said, no, oddly enough. So he took it very well. He took it very well, and I miss him dearly. And we were at this conference. Well, he was at Canadian Psychological Association, which I just don't care about. But I was there for Brain Behavior and Cognitive Science. And he said, let's go to this talk that I saw on the list, because it's about evolutionary psychology and social psychology, and he's a social psychologist, or was. So I said, that sounds fine, we went early. And this guy, he said, we should just go. This is really cool. And the guy found that there are nicotine receptors in the GABA system, in other words, and GABA calms you down. So in fact, there is a physiological basis for this that we didn't know about. Okay. Questions about nicotine? By the way, nicotine, the drug, is also bad for you, not just the smoking itself. The smoking is bad for you. The actual inhalation of smoke is just not good for your lungs. Right? But nicotine itself is bad for your heart, for example. Nicotine's not a good drug to be taking. So even when you take the patch to stop smoking, which is way more healthy than smoking, you still eventually ought to stop the patch, which you're supposed to.
Okay, what about other drugs like that are hallucinogenic, like LSD and other drugs?
LSD, basically, it's like you're taking a bunch of serotonin. It is about 110-minute half-life, LSD. Psilocybin is pretty similar. This was something that originally Timothy Leary told people to do, which is to tune in, turn on, and drop out. Yes, leave society and start taking magic mushrooms. That said, which, by the way, this is one of the things that can get you fired as a university professor, even if you have tenure. He was fired from Harvard because he was giving his students magic mushrooms. Probably shouldn't be in class. You know? I can even say, okay, look, on his own time, still, you probably shouldn't be doing anything illegal with your students. But in class, also faculty meetings. Now, I've thought about this, to be honest with you. Because it would make meetings go much better.
Hey,
yes?
I have a question. It's a little off topic. It's about marijuana.
We'll get to marijuana.
We'll get to it?
Yeah, we'll get to it.
Oh, wait.
Oh, we're getting there, baby. If I remember. So, about 110-minute half-life. These are pretty similar drugs, magic mushrooms and LSD. So are morning glory seeds. So if you go to the Canadian Tire and go to the flower section, see morning glory seeds, and you eat them, you're an idiot. But you eat enough of them, they have hallucinogenic problems. So it's harmine, which you don't see very much anymore. It's more of a 60s, 70s thing. So is toe flicking. So this is interesting because, in fact, it's probably the case that no one ever really licked a toe. Oh, somebody probably. But a paper came out saying that these toads released something like LSD as a defense. Why is that a defense? Well, when an animal eats one of these toads, it hallucinates. And most of your predatory, you know, it's Australia, so most of your predatory wombats and what have you aren't walking around going, you know, I want to open up the doors of ascension, mate. They're Australian animals. They talk with that accent. So that's unpleasant, and they're all brightly colored. And those of you guys that are biology students probably know about aposematism, the idea of a brightly colored and poisonous animal. So what happens is next time you run into another one that's one of these sort of blue-colored toads. It's the same kind of toad, the Views logo, for those of you that use BitTorrent legally. So you don't eat any of the toads, but they tend to be relevant to solids and inclusive fitness. Okay? This comes out, it's cool paper. People go, well, you could make toads. Well, you could. You could. But I will say that, and there probably are cases, but it's trumped up a lot because Australia is the most urbanized country in the world. But 90% of Australians live in cities. I think you can probably get some acid. You know, I don't think it's probably that hard to get. I don't think you go up to some shady guy in a bar. You go up these toads? Guys who sell acid to you. Acid's almost impossible to overdose on. In fact, it pretty much is impossible. You can take so much acid you think you could fly. That's not an overdose. That's taking a lot and getting really screwed up and jumping off a building. That does happen. It's really rare. Zach asked me a couple days ago about flashbacks. And yeah, there are acid flashbacks. No one really knows why.
What about cases where people don't come down?
No, they come down. But you can take a lot of acid and be tripping for a very long time. The guy that discovered LSD, whose last name is, I think, Müller, was a Swiss chemist. He's a Swiss chemist. And he discovered this stuff, and he took it, mistakenly, he ingested a small amount, and he rode his bike home and didn't go to work for a week. He actually campaigned the rest of his life about, you know, making it illegal because he thought it was very dangerous. But now, you've got to understand, when you take acid, and some of you guys know this, and I'd be able to tell by the number of you that get shocked by this number, he took a quarter of a milligram of acid, and you measure hits of acid in micrograms. So he took about 2,500 hits of acid. He he's fine. Well, until he died when he was 89 years old.
Will people ever take acid, and if they're psychotic, have psychotic, maybe you have already have problems, will it help or hurt their schizophrenic?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It'll make you, yeah, that's bad.
People generally with psychological problems shouldn't take recreational drugs. It's a bad idea. It's a very bad idea. Right? Very bad idea. But, you know, again, I'm not encouraging you to take this. Again, I've never touched this stuff, partially because anybody that has, like, grade 8 level lab bench skills that can make it in their basement, I don't want the drugs. I just don't want to take anything of this. Now, there are other drugs like this that are, like, norepinephrine and acetylcholine. MDMA, STP, mescaline, nutmeg, yes, it's true. The amount of nutmeg, however, you have to eat to get hallucinations, just go find a toad to lick. It's a lot of nutmeg. Mandrake, a relative of the potato. Deadly nightshade, also relative of the potato. I would never take anything with the name deadly in it. Right?
It's just this general rule.
PCP, which is angel dust. These things can be dangerous. Because too much norepinephrine or acetylcholine, that can have a muscular sort of thing going on. Special K, ketamine. All right. So that's hallucinogens. Now, marijuana, we're going to talk a little bit about the weed, about the reefer, wacky tobacco. By the way, this is a funny movie, Reefer Madness. It's put up by the U.S. Department of Education. It's also available on archive.org. It's free to download because of copyright stuff. So if you go to archive.org and check out Reefer Madness, it's really, really funny. It's meant to be a frightening, dangerous movie. But it's really funny. My favorite part, I'm not going to spoil the movie for you because you really should watch it. It's funny. The ending's hilarious. If you know anybody who's ever smoked weed, it'll kill you. It's funny as hell. And even if you think marijuana is evil, which you might and you're free to, you'll still find this funny because you will know how overblown this is. The best part of the movie, though, here's the dealer, by the way. He really looks like a dealer, doesn't he? He's got a jacket and tie on. And he's lighting her cigarette or her joint. And by the way, they're always perfectly rolled. They look just like cigarettes, except they're darker. And he gets her to play the piano. And he's just going, play faster. Play faster. It's a wonderful moment. So this is a good one. This is for this one over here is from another movie like this, but it's actually a... this is a real movie called Marijuana, Weed from the Devil's Garden, which I've seen, which is really funny. It's meant as like an exploitation film, like a sort of a second movie you would see in a drive-in. It's that kind of thing they used to have in the 40s and 50s. A couple of funny things. Wild orgies, wild parties, and unleashed passions. I don't know, but I've seen people high very rarely by some unleashed passions. It doesn't happen. You know, people are just like, well, they don't go, yeah, and then I thought we should all have sex. That doesn't happen. I also like the fact, look at this, misery. Because like, people apparently are injecting the marijuana. Apparently injecting the marijuana. And this person's got a lot of weed. Look at this. That's Satan, I think, right? Anyway, it's pretty funny. Okay, so that's a traditional view. By the way, Reefer Madness starts out with some guy from the U.S. Department of Education telling you about marijuana, and it's just so funny. There are cannabinoid receptors. Okay? How are they discovered? Well, one group at NIMH in the States, National Institute of Mental Health, one lab group was looking at a synthetic cannabinoid. Labetalol, tradol, rather, and they had it radioactive. When it's radioactive, you can then see where it binds in the brain. Okay. Another group had it found a gene that coded for a receptor. And the maps matched, which is pretty cool. It shows science is cool, it seems to me, and about the amount of serendipity in science. they're obviously both working on cannabinoids, but it's pretty cool that they found the gene that codes for cannabinoid receptors and exactly where it expresses itself. That's neat. I always have this idea that they bumped into each other and they picked up each other's maps of the brand. But I get this idea. So that's kind of neat. So we know that at where, this is the early 80s, but a little later than that. Mid to late 80s, I think it was 86. Okay, where do you have THC receptors? THC is the active ingredient in marijuana, specifically delta-9 THC, tetrahydrocannabinol. Just call it THC, that's fine. The cortex, hippocampus. Well, think about this. Cortex, marijuana has effects on higher cognitive function. When you're high, it's hard to think straight. Hippocampus, this is why people lose their train of thought. Right? Because people, they'll be talking to you and they'll be talking about, and then there's, right? That happens. Because you lose your train of thought, hippocampus, important in memory. Cerebellum, important in balance, and people get a little, and you know how you feel kind of, or so you perhaps have heard, that you feel like you get kind of, you stand up after you've been sitting, because nobody smokes weed standing up. You sit down, you get a little, okay, yeah, that's quite good. Basal ganglia, this is going to be between limbic and system and the cortex, that makes some sense there. Spinal cord, cool. It actually can block signals, including pain signals. Marijuana is a great drug that way. Brainstem. Sleep and wakefulness, right? And you know that it can make you very sleepy. Hypothalamus. Why do you think you get hungry? It's not because you're actually hungry. Well, you feel hungry. You feel hungry. You end up eating whole chickens that your friend said, don't eat that chicken. It's like a TV show. My mom cooked this chicken. Don't eat it. I have to go pee. I'll be back in 90 seconds. My mom cooked this chicken for us to have chicken sandwiches and stuff throughout the week. Okay, we won't. And he goes on, he comes back, and we just had chicken fat all over our faces. And so we go, we ate a whole chicken in 90 seconds. He said, did you guys eat that chicken? We went, no. So I misspent youth. Now, I will say that we did cook another chicken. Oh, it's fair. Your spleen. Wow, your spleen? This might have something to do with the fact that the antibiotic effects. Pretty cool. Okay. You wanted to ask a question about the
weed? Yeah. People always say, oh, smoking marijuana is bad. Well, I mean, if you smoke it, then yeah, it smokes
it. Smoke itself is good for you. There's no way.
Exactly. But yeah. Like ingesting it or using like a vaporizer where you just basically like, shut the THC.
Yeah, the THC itself is probably not that dangerous. But even think about this. Even smoked marijuana, which is, you know, still for most people the preferred route of administration. Smoking cigarettes is one thing, because people smoke 20 and 30 and 40 a day. The quality of marijuana nowadays is that people don't have to smoke a whole joint anymore. Take a couple of hits from a one-hitter. That's right, I'm hip with the scene. One-hitter, and you're high. Right? So the smoke itself, I'm not saying that smoking is never good for you, no matter what you're smoking. Right? But the amount that you actually smoke is so small. By the way, here's a tip. You don't have to hold it in. That does not increase the amount that gets to your blood system. You inhale it, and you blow it out. Just saying. No. That guy, he's wasting his time. Seriously. You ever see smokers? Think about this. Who's the expert in smoking? People smoke cigarettes. You ever see people smoke? You don't see it. They inhale and they blow it out. Yes,
Ben. I have a question because people often say it has a link to schizophrenia or something.
Again, it's something, and just like she asked, if you have
any problems psychologically, like sort of that are close to schizophrenia, it's one of those cases where, yeah, it's true that people that smoke, sort of people that already have those kind of symptoms, really shouldn't be doing those drugs. Because you get, when you know what you expect to when you're going to be high, it's fun. That's why people do it. But besides the sort of reward effects, the actual sort of the laughing, the losing your train of thought, all that, that's kind of part of the experience. When that happens, when you've already got psychotic problems, those kind of issues, that can cause real issues with people that have things like schizophrenia. They really shouldn't be smoking marijuana at all. They shouldn't be doing any of these kind of drugs, except for the antipsychotic drugs we talked about.
Yeah, good question. Same kind of thing. You don't... These are not drugs for people that are already having problems.
Yeah.
Marijuana has some great effects, though. I mean, it also acts as an anticonvulsant. It's a great anti-epilepsy medication, for example.
There's all kinds of claims about it having anti-cancer.
Yeah, I've heard that. I haven't seen any data. And I doubt it. That would really surprise me. I'm just saying it's... Because typically, it would surprise me if a single drug did something to cancer. You know? I'll say it also affects, it decreases the pressure on the fluid in your eyes, so that's why it's used for glaucoma. It is a good pain medication for chronic pain. Report that they take a couple of hits and their pain goes away. It has antibiotic effects. It has anti-nausea effects, which is interesting. In fact, one of the very common enough anti-nausea drug that's given for seasickness is called Marinol, and it's a synthetic cannabinoid in a pill form. And what they really ought to be handing out when you get on the ferry between Newfoundland and Nova Scotia, they ought to just be handing out, just giving people a little bong hit, and then they'd be fine. And then they'd actually eat that horrible food in those little cafeteria on that ferry. A couple of you have been on had that. It's horrible. Worst food you've ever had in your life. It makes over here look like a great culinary experience. Like it's actually menutainment. So that's fine. Right. Other things about marijuana or say about it? I mean, again, if you can get one more in. Yes, please.
Just one drug we haven't talked about. How does Ritalin affect your brain? And how does Ritalin affect your brain if you take it and you don't have ADD?
Ritalin is a psychomotor stimulant. Okay. It's methylphenidrate, is what it's called. And it's just a stimulant. So one of the things is that when people who have ADHD, the theory goes, and in fact it seems to be supported, that they aren't, in certain parts of their brain, they don't have enough catecholamines. Folks have to say that. So, and in fact, there seems to be some data suggesting that. In fact, if you give people with ADHD Ritalin, it can help focus them. In fact, it's the case that small amounts of stimulants focus people. Indeed, airline pilots fly simulators better after taking small amounts of cocaine. Not in the air. We don't. That experiment's not been done. But, so stimulants do focus. Small amounts of them. So when you take Ritalin as someone with ADHD, it actually has positive, it helps you. And it also stops, you might wonder, why does that stop hyperactivity if you're giving people a stimulant? Because, in fact, they can focus on the work, the kids say, in school, and they don't get distracted so easily and run around and wreck stuff. On the other hand, you can take Ritalin recreationally. A lot of people get Ritalin recreationally because their little brother has ADHD. And they take it and crush it up and they snort it. Right? You can eat them, but if you want to get any high at all, you're going to snort it. That's a tip. So it just acts as any other stimulant when you take it. Because if your brain, if you don't have ADHD, you don't have the need for the drug itself. So all you're going to get is the fun parts. The other interesting thing is you will hear people say that people are just drugging children with Ritalin to just keep them down. You don't give people stimulants to keep them down. You give them, if you wanted to just keep children down, we just give them tincture of opium, like they used to do in the Victorian era, to quiet children. Right? Little opium, little alcohol, kids go right to sleep. Right. Other questions?
Hey, what about brain damage?
First of all, a lot of that stuff's way overblown. I mean, Look, if you devote your life to doing nothing other than smoking marijuana, yeah, it probably will hurt you at some point. But the idea that all these drugs put holes in your brain and all this stuff is really pretty ridiculous. Long-term, chronic, daily use, yeah, it might. But it's hard to find people to do those experiments, do those studies with. There's a couple of reasons. You're talking about something that's illegal. So get people to sign up and say, yeah, I've been smoking weed every day to excess for the last 20 years, do an MRI on it. Most people aren't going to admit to that. And they might admit to marijuana, but none of them will admit to ecstasy. None of them will admit to heroin. Most people don't live for 20 years after doing that themselves with heroin. You tend to die more quickly from other things than you think from issues or brain issues. You've heard a lot probably about how alcohol destroys brain cells. That's a crock of shit. It's not true. It just simply isn't true. It doesn't destroy brain cells. A lot of things get said, and enough people believe it, and then it just becomes something people say. It's like Columbus went around the world. You know why? To prove the world wasn't flat. Not why. Because he wanted to go find spices and gold and stuff. You know, he knew the world was round. No one on the ship was going, oh no, we're going to fly. That was Bugs Bunny. The same kind of thing. You hear this stuff fly. Again, I think chronic use of anything like that is probably good for you. Again, your brain will adjust. Right? So you'll make fewer receptors of some sort. The danger more comes in overdosing on certain drugs. That's the danger. Because what happens is people, because you learn, it's all about learning, right? If you learn that you need, your body learns you need this much heroin to get the kick you want. And then you also learn in that context, I'm supposed to be in this place when I take heroin. Okay? Now what happens is you get this compensatory response. Your body gets ready for the heroin. But now if you're not in the same place, you take more, you take the regular amount, but you don't have the compensatory response to produce it. A lot of guys had that happen to them when they returned from Vietnam. Most people that take drugs know how much they need. But yeah, the idea of the brain damage stuff, I mean, there's not enough data suggesting any of this is true. I'm not saying it's probably, none of these things are good for you. That'd be crazy for me to say. So some conclusions, drugs are fine. What do I mean by that? That's why people take them. They operate the reward system. And the conditioning is the idea that they make something feel good, so if behavior happens, then you feel better. That's what people take. And the other question is, you got to. I think it's important to talk about the truth instead of lies. That's all. I mean, I think it's really important to say that heroin's safer than alcohol. The way we measure safety. We'll talk a lot about this in the neuropharm class, but I mean, you know, there's things like heroin can be a real problem, and in a lot of bigger cities it is a problem, and the way you control it is not by putting people in jail. And there's data behind this. The way you control it is you have safe injection sites. You know, has Dutch society shut down because it's legal to smoke marijuana in Amsterdam? No, they seem fine. Everything seems to work. In Britain, you know how you, if you're a heroin addict, you register with the National Health Service as a heroin addict, and you show up in the morning at the clinic, and you get your heroin. And you get it in a place where you get a clean injection, you know what you're taking. So. Don't mix science and morality, okay? That's the big thing. Some stuff is bad for you, some stuff's good for you. I mean, it's none of my business what you do to your body, but I don't think we should have. Could it inform morality? Sure. But don't confuse science and morality. It's a bad idea. I just don't think it's a good idea at all. All right. Questions about drugs in general? Where are we? All right. A little bit about hormones. Not nearly as much as we have about drugs because I don't teach a course in endocrinology. Basically, these are chemicals that work a lot. A lot like drugs. Sorry. Like neurotransmitters. Except they don't work on neurons, they work on organs. And sometimes in certain brain regions. These are secreted by various glands in your body. And mostly, excuse me, what they're mostly doing are three things. They're doing homeostasis, so keeping your body steady state. They have reproductive hormones, and there are stress hormones. Okay? Okay. So, what happens is typically the hypothalamus, which monitors a lot of things about your blood chemistry, etc., sends what are called releasing factors to the pituitary gland. And the pituitary is the master gland, tells certain glands to make certain hormones. Okay? The hormones themselves enter cells, and they do this by binding to receptors. I mean, it's the same kind of thing. Except instead of opening an ion channel, they'll start a chemical reaction that turns on a gene and it makes it make a protein.
Okay?
This, you know, as far as our brain goes, isn't really nearly as interesting as the rest of your body. You spend a lot less time on this, but it does affect your behavior. This is your autonomic nervous system, right? So you make proteins, which, again, turn on other genes, etc. Okay, so sex hormones. Testosterone is one of the ones that we like to, you know, quote, male hormone, people call it. Testosterone, the interesting thing here for our sake, I think, is that it contributes to the male superiority of spatial tasks. And that, by the way, happens in other species too, not just humans. So it's the case that in humans, male humans are better than female humans at spatial tasks on average. But it's also the case that we see that in rats, and we see that in cowbirds. So in birds, in all kinds of animals. There's something important about testosterone. It's probably something to do with brain organization. So that's part of it, that it's due to brain organization during development. But it's also at a given time. So if I give a woman a shot of testosterone, her spatial ability goes up. I give a man a shot of testosterone too, except there's more. There's less room to improve. progesterone and estradiol, which are two, quote, female hormones, low levels of those, females do better with spatial tasks. Higher levels, they don't do so well in spatial tasks, but their verbal superiority shows up. So female humans are better than male humans at verbal tasks, things like spelling and grammar. So this is where the female superiority part shows up, and that's in these hormones increasing, showing a bigger difference. And again, we can take those hormones, give them to a guy, and he'll do better on a verbal task. Or a group of guys. Okay? I think I told you about this earlier on in the course, is if we take a female rat pup and give her testosterone. Well, I talked about this, right? She does better on a maze than a female rat pup that wasn't given testosterone when she gets older, and also does better on a maze, does as well on a maze than a male rat when she's older. I talked about that, right? When I talked about psychoneuroendocrinology. Stress hormones, what they're doing is that's the control of the autonomic nervous system and the sympathetic and parasympathetic. Sympathetic nervous system is the fight or flight response. Right? And what they're going to do is they're going to do things like divert sugar from one part, from say your gut where you're digesting, and take it to quick twitch muscles so you can run away or fight. What happens is your brain itself recognizes the stressor, and you get the release of epinephrine and cortisol. Now, epinephrine's a neurotransmitter, but when it's in the bloodstream, it acts as a hormone. And in fact, you can taste epinephrine. You can taste adrenaline if you're really, really, really under a lot of stress. And I don't mean like I'm writing a test. I mean like I'm being robbed. And you get a taste in your mouth that tastes like milk.
and not the same taste as when you, you know, bite your tongue and it bleeds. I mean, it's a metallic taste in your mouth.
Epinephrine turns on everything, and cortisol shuts stuff down.
So you shut certain systems down, turn certain systems on when you're under a really stressful situation.
Now, cortisol levels themselves are controlled by hippocampus, which is interesting because it also has that important thing to do with episodic memory consolidation, but it also seems to, it monitors cortisol levels. It ends up, you get cortisol also in your brain, and the weird thing is too much cortisol in your brain actually can lead to damage, and it damages hippocampus. That's crazy. So it's actually, over very long periods of stress, that will cause damage. And again, not just a little stress. Right? Not just the odd test, things like that. That's not, you know, don't go to your prof and say, you keep damaging me, man. You have too many papers to do. You're hurting my hippocampus. I can't even remember where I am. No one's going to buy that, I hope. Somebody might. Not sure. Won't name names. Just saying, I think some people might. Nobody in our department. Not anybody in biology. Good for you on them. I'm not sure. I'm kidding. I don't think anybody. I hope. So it's an insidious kind of system, actually. It's very strange because it controls it, but with too much cortisol, you actually get damaged.
So we spent 4 days on drugs and, 12 minutes on hormones. These hormones are boring. No, I would like you to read the chapter. I just think it's boring, so I don't want to talk about it. All right, questions? Okay, because it's park break week, I gotta go get picked up by Isabel's gonna take me home, and then I'm going to Jonathan, but she's gonna come back and do class. So, class is over.
Look over the development stuff next time. Thanks, guys.
I hold a grudge forever. You look the same as you used to. Impaled by an arrow, killed everything I thought was true. It's not you I'm thinking of. It's not you I'm dreaming of. Thank you.
podcast is released under a Creative Commons copyright, share alike 2.5 Canada. Feel free to redistribute the information as you see fit, but please don't make any money out of it. And if you do, you got to tell me, because I'm reserving that right. Giving up all the other ones, including mash it up any way you want, okay? Also, of course, give me attribution. If you want to get a hold of me, my email address is dave.brodbeck, B-R-O-D-B-E-C-K, at algomau.ca. My website is people.auc.ca/broadbeck/blog. Most of the music, all the music's PodSafe, and most of it comes from GarageBand.com or the PodSafe Music Network. See you next time.